Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The top United Nations American official in Afghanistan, Peter Galbraith, was fired yesterday over scathing accusations he made of election fraud and UN cover-up in the re-election push of incumbent Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Peter Galbraith is no shrinking violet, not in the Balkans or Iraq or in Kabul. Now he's out of Afghanistan and still talking as President Obama decides whether to send more U.S. troops to support Afghanistan and Karzai. This hour, On Point, Peter Galbraith was fired yesterday. He's with us today on Afghanistan and the way ahead. Joining me now from Townsend, Vermont, is Ambassador Peter Galbraith. He was the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia from 1993 to 1998. Very active in issues of the Iraq War and Kurdistan. He was a longtime staff member for the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. He was announced as the top American official in the U.N.'s mission in Afghanistan in March. Yesterday, he was fired from that position. Peter Galbraith, welcome to On Point.
Tom, very good to be with you again.
We know you're a diplomat, but give us the unvarnished version. Why are you out?
Well, first, Tom, in your introduction, there was no connection between my recall, that's the diplomatic term for being fired, and the letter that I sent. The decision had to do with a dispute between Kai Eide, the head of the mission, and myself over how to handle electoral fraud. It was a long-running disagreement, as I outline in the letter that the New York Times has published about, going back to July. Basically, I felt that the United Nations had to be serious about its mandate to support free, fair, and transparent elections. And at various stages of the process, the head of the mission opposed the effort to do something about opposed concrete steps to risk the to diminish the risk of fraud, and then once the fraud took place, to try to correct it.
Ambassador Galbraith, you say no connection, but you told the Times, "I was not prepared to be complicit in a cover-up or in an effort to downplay the fraud that took place," and you really distilled your accusations of that fraud and cover-up in this letter, and now you're out. Is there not room in the UN mission for this kind of very critical voice of what went on? You accused the head of the UN mission there of actually siding with President incumbent Karzai.
Again, the decision on my recall was made before I sent the letter. But the letter was in response to what was an impending decision because I felt it was necessary to explain to the Secretary General exactly what the issues were in the dispute with Kai Eide. And yes, the Kai Eide told me that he was biased toward President Karzai, although he also said that he didn't believe that he was not supporting Karzai, but that he wanted the man to win.
We'll look at what happened in that election with you. Few people were closer to it than you were, Peter Galbraith. But right now, as everybody knows, the White House is in the middle of very intense talks about whether to send 40,000 more, perhaps, U.S. troops to Afghanistan. There's a lot of concern about the legitimacy of a Karzai government if that's where we end up, and Washington appears prepared to accept that. Do you think if it's Karzai, will the United States and more troops be dealing with a legitimate government in Kabul?
I think that's a very important question. The President Obama strategy requires a partner who is credible. We cannot do the job in Afghanistan on our own. We need to have a credible Afghan government that is interested in providing services to the people, that is capable of providing good, honest administration on the both the national and the local level, and whose tenure in office is accepted by the Afghan people. the Karzai government has been characterized for the last 7 years by corruption and ineffectiveness. And now, if President Karzai, in fact, continues in office, it will be the product of an election that in which there was a massive fraud. I'm not saying that President Karzai would not have won anyhow. I think it's quite possible that he would have won, and certainly if there was a runoff. But nonetheless, the fraud has tainted the credibility of the process, and therefore will certainly affect how Afghans, and particularly those who supported Karzai's opponents, see the legitimacy of the government.
Let's look at that. Ambassador Peter Galbraith is with us, recalled, i.e. fired yesterday from the UN mission in Afghanistan. If you'd listen with us for a second, Ambassador, here's U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates on Sunday on ABC's This Week, and he was asked if the United States is rethinking whether it can support President Karzai's government or whether the U.S. should back away given the charges of election fraud.
The Afghan people have gone to the polls, and we have the two election commissions, one internal, one international, that could still come to conclusions, even if they throw out some fraudulent ballots or a number of fraudulent ballots, that there was a clear winner. The key is whether the Afghans believe that their government has legitimacy. And everything that I've seen in the intelligence and elsewhere indicates that remains the case.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates asserting that Afghans believe their government has legitimacy. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, recently back from Afghanistan and out of the UN mission, do you believe that's the case? Do you see Afghans accepting this as their legitimate government? And if so, is that good enough?
Well, a large number of Afghans may well accept Karzai as a legitimate president, but there will be a significant number who, because of the irregularities, or not the irregularities is too mild a word, because of the extensive fraud in the election, who probably will not accept him as his legitimacy, and that is certainly going to complicate the situation that we face. Let me say something else about Secretary Gates' comments. It is true that the results are being examined by an election complaints commission, which is has three international members of the five. It's a body that's set up under Afghan law. But the problem with that process is that they have to prove fraud. It's difficult to detect all the fraud, especially when it's taken place on this scale. So inevitably, there's going to be questions about the outcome of the election.
If there had not been fraud, would President Karzai have been forced into a runoff against the second-place finisher, Abdullah Abdullah? Is that your position?
I think that seems to be likely, based on what we know about the results. And indeed, on the 6th of September, the Independent Election Commission, this is a purely Afghan body whose members were appointed by Karzai, they reaffirmed their published procedures, which would have excluded certain categories of fraudulent ballots from the count. That night, they learned that if they stayed with those procedures, then there likely would be a runoff. The next morning, they reconvened and all of a sudden discovered a provision of Afghan electoral law that they had previously been unaware of that gave them no legal authority to exclude obviously fraudulent ballots. They then included the obviously fraudulent ballots in the final tally, and it was those ballots that raised Karzai from about 47% to 54%. And therefore, if those preliminary returns were to hold up, he would have avoided a runoff.
Ambassador Galbraith, I want to press this point of how Afghans see the outcome or emerging outcome. If they find it good enough, is that a good enough basis for foreign troops, including American troops, maybe many more of them, to be fighting with and for this government? Do you see an adequate base in the population of support, or are we headed into a situation where, you know, a lot of Afghans say this isn't really our government, and now here's the United States and the rest of NATO fighting for it, even though we didn't elect it?
Well, that is the question that we face. It's a little hard to know how Afghans are going to interpret the election result, given the fraud that took place. I suppose that clearly President Karzai has a very significant amount of support, and I would imagine that most of his supporters will accept his continuation in office. The problem comes with those who supported his opponents, and there is an ethnic dimension to this. The main challenger, Abdullah Abdullah, is a Tajik. That is from Afghanistan's second largest ethnic group. His base of support is significantly in the northern part of the country. And so what these elections may do is add a new dimension to the crisis in Afghanistan, that is conflict between the Pashtuns, of which Karzai is a member, and Abdullah and the Tajiks. So far, the conflict in Afghanistan has been largely between the government and the Taliban, which is a purely Pashtun insurgency.
You know, but you couldn't go along. The Deputy or Undersecretary General of the United Nations said they expect a team to move in a unified fashion, and you are not prepared to stay on board.
No, I was prepared to stay on board. That's the irony of this situation. What we had here was a private disagreement between myself and Kaidi, the head of the mission. I recognized that he was the one who got to call the shots. Any diplomatic organization is an hierarchical organization.
Yeah, but there's a couple of voices. First, from the from Hamid Karzai himself, and then we'll hear from John McCain. But here's the incumbent talking about the elections.
There were irregularities, as there are in all other elections, but the way this election was undermined the day after the election by part of the international press was unfortunate and regretful, and I hope now something is done by all of us together to make it right. The Afghan government is credible and legitimate.
Credible and legitimate, says the sitting president, who Peter Galbraith says was the beneficiary of election fraud and a UN blind eye. Here's Senator John McCain on ABC's This Week on Sunday saying the election was bad, but a surge of U.S. troops, despite the government's troubles, is necessary.
This election in Afghanistan is corrupt. There is corruption from the cop on the beat to the president's brother, Karzai's brother. And that issue has to be addressed if we're going to succeed. But we're not going to have a chance to succeed if we withdraw. And by the way, we've really got the status quo, which Admiral Mullen and General McChrystal say is not succeeding, or we can implement this new strategy, which is really an old strategy called counterinsurgency, or we better get out.
Senator John McCain, just a couple of days ago, Ambassador Galbraith, how do you see this argument? Yes, he says it was corrupt. Many say there was fraud, but realism, real politic, is the U.S. needs to stay in. How do you look at that, sir?
I certainly agree with that. We have a very important interest in Afghanistan, as does the world community, and we need to stay engaged. The immediate question is whether it makes sense in these circumstances to send additional troops. And I think in order to accomplish what one needs to accomplish with the additional troops, you need to have a credible partner. And at this point in time, it's hard to see that credible partner is there.
You just heard Hamid Karzai in that tape saying the Afghan government is credible and legitimate. Of course, he's still sitting at the top of it. What else can he say? But I guess you're flat out disagreeing.
Well, I'm not taking a stand on that issue. That's really for the Afghan people to determine. My point is much more narrow, and that is that the elections that took place, the presidential elections, were characterized by massive fraud, and that does make it does undermine the credibility of the outcome, and will certainly affect how Afghans see the legitimacy of the government that follows. But that's really the observations of an analyst. No, I'm not rendering my own verdict, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to do so.
Sounds like it speaks directly to credibility to me. Let's hear from our listeners, if we may. Ambassador Peter Galbraith is with us, recalled, fired yesterday by the UN after his service in Afghanistan, watching the elections in particular. Let's get a call from Allendale, South Carolina. Wilbert, you're on the air with Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Peter Galbraith, I agree. You're absolutely correct. When you have a government that comes to power through fraud and election, and you talk about a counterinsurgency program, you end up putting Afghans in villages that they could be protected. The best thing for them to do is to come up for government of national unity and include the folks in the north in the government. But as long as there's this whole thing of a fraudulent election, we're wasting our time.
Wilbert, thanks very much for your call. Ambassador Galbraith, could you see the kind of perceived number two here? Who knows? He might have been number one. Abdullah joining in a kind of unity government? Is that in the cards?
He says that he will not join in a unity government. He certainly, as a candidate, his stature increased enormously during the campaign. He feels he's the head of a movement. And so what he would seek is a constitutional change in Afghanistan that would enable power sharing, and that may be a sensible solution. Afghanistan has a highly centralized constitution with what is in effect a winner-take-all system where all power rests with the president, and yet it is a very diverse country both ethnically and geographically. And if there were constitutional change, we still have a president, but perhaps with powers limited to defense and foreign affairs, national security, and then share it with a prime minister who could be from a different ethnic group, with cabinet ministers who exercise their authority not by virtue of appointment by the president, but by virtue of the political base that you have, then you might genuinely be able to get to some kind of system of power sharing of national unity. It might be a more effective way to address the problems in Afghanistan. I want to emphasize, that's a solution for the Afghan people to decide. It's not something that can be imposed or even proposed by the international community.
Did you perceive any openness to that on the part of the Karzai government?
No, but that doesn't mean that this might not be the subject of discussions or negotiations in the months ahead.
Peter Galbraith, recalled, i.e. fired, yesterday by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon after what were reported as, and we hear it here, irreconcilable differences over the UN mission's handling of the Afghan election. Susan, in Boston, you're on the air with Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Yes, hello. I'm a journalist, and I interviewed Peter Galbraith in Croatia about the Bosnian War. And he was always a voice of honesty and clarity in what was a very complex situation. I don't know the details of this situation in particular because I haven't covered the Afghan election. But if listeners are wondering whom to believe, I have found Peter Galbraith to be a very credible and trustworthy source. He would speak to journalists at a time when other officials would run away from us and elude us and mislead us. So I think he has a lot of credibility. My question is this. I mean, corruption is rampant in the third world and in war zones. So that would seem not to be a reason to prevent more troops from going there, since much of Afghanistan is unaffected by the central government. I mean, can we proceed? Can we both add troops and try to reform the government at the same time?
Peter Galbraith, corruption's rampant in the third world, so what if there was some fraud, or even massive fraud, as you say?
Well, let me address that. First, let me thank Susan for her very kind words and for the chance to be interviewed, as it were, by her again. Certainly, corruption exists in the third world, although Afghanistan ranks very close to the bottom of the list on the Transparency International ranking of corruption. The problem, corruption is part of it, but in addition, there's ineffectiveness, and probably most important, it is that in parts of the country, the way in which Afghans experience government is in the form of abuse of power. They see warlords or local power brokers able to operate with impunity, that even if they could make use of the legal system for redress of grievances, in fact, nothing actually happens. And so I think it is that sense of injustice that actually has helped fuel the insurgency. Incidentally, it's clear that most Afghans do not support the Taliban. Most Pashtuns do not support the Taliban. But in a circumstance where the choice is between the Taliban and this a government that is seen to be corrupt and ineffective, a large part of the population simply stays on the sidelines. They're certainly not prepared to risk their lives and property to assist the government.
But enough are prepared to be involved on one side or another that a lot of people are dying there. 22 Taliban militants killed yesterday, and we've seen the U.S. and NATO casualties. Here's a bit of tape from yesterday from Ban Ki-moon, the U.N. Secretary General spokeswoman Michelle Montas. She was asked by an Al Jazeera reporter to explain your dismissal, Ambassador Galbraith. And here's this carefully worded statement confirming the move without exactly giving a reason.
The Secretary General has made this decision in the best interest of the mission.
Can you elaborate on that? What reasons was Mr. Galbraith given for his dismissal?
I cannot say add any more to this. The statement is explicit.
The U.N. Secretary General spokeswoman adds no more detail, but there's a lot of detail out there. Here, another Al Jazeera interview with the Afghan presidential candidate, Abdullah Abdullah, number two, at least by the election results that we got, commented on the firing of Peter Galbraith.
If the issue was based on the fact that he was for vigorous look into the issue of fraud, he was... in that case, I will say that he has been talking on behalf of the people of Afghanistan.
Abdullah, number two, purportedly in the Afghan elections there on Ambassador Galbraith's recall or firing. How do you feel about the rest of the sort of politicians who got involved here? Let's say Abdullah, Ambassador, who, you know, still waiting by his lights for a legitimate, credible outcome here. What does this whole experience say to them?
Well, I think the timing of this decision really was unfortunate. It was very clear to Afghans, as Dr. Abdullah said, that my position was to advocate for a more vigorous investigation of the fraud, more vigorous action to delete fraudulent ballots from the count. And so when a UN official is dismissed for having been concerned about electoral fraud, and you're a candidate in the election or a supporter of a candidate in the election, and your candidate has come out on the short end of the fraud, naturally your confidence in the international community is going to be diminished.
I mean, our caller Susan said earlier, look, there's a lot of corruption in the third world, but isn't it different when you have such a big UN and NATO and U.S. presence in a country specifically looking at an election?
Precisely. The international community in the United Nations paid $300 million for these elections. The UN was involved at every stage of the election process, printing of the ballots, the logistics and the distribution of them, the acquiring of ink, the indelible ink, so that people couldn't vote twice. This isn't a situation where these elections were being run by a country, and then you're in the position of commenting on their internal affairs. The UN was an integral part of this. And I have to say that among the professional staff of the United Nations who work on elections in many parts of the world, yes, they've seen fraudulent elections, but they've never seen one quite like this, where the UN had been so intricately involved.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Until yesterday, he was the second highest-ranking UN official in the UN in the UN's Afghan mission. He joins us today from Vermont. Let's get a call from South Burlington, Vermont. And Rick, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
Too often, I think public officials have private reservations about policy, and simply express them but subordinate them in a larger sense and more public sense in order to continue in their position. Peter, I want to say thank you for standing up for the principles you believe in this case, despite that it's cost you your position. I hope and believe that it will lead to a larger public discussion and a more effective, perhaps, policy response. So thank you for that. But the larger question that I have is this. Is it, in your mind, possible for the United States to carve out a strategy that, given the current conditions on the ground, the current corruption, can actually be effective enough in turning around the situation? In other words, can we carve a successful strategy out, in your opinion, given what's going on, or is it simply too large a mountain to climb? I'd be interested in your response.
Ambassador Galbraith.
Well, Rick, thank you for the kind words. Let me just say that, yes, I certainly hope that public officials do stand up for principles. But I also support the idea that if you are in a diplomatic assignment, you need to stick to the policy, and if you can't, you should resign. But you also need to be forceful in how you express it internally. And I want to emphasize that I did not publicly dissent to the policy. This was an internal disagreement. I had a point of view. I expressed it. But I accepted that the head of the mission had the right to make the decisions. He was appointed by the Secretary General. I left Afghanistan in the middle of September because I realized that he didn't have confidence that I would follow his lead, and I didn't have confidence in his judgment. I thought we both agreed it would be good to have a short period of time so that he could do what he wanted, and then I would return. Now, to address to your larger question, I actually don't know the answer to that.
That is, whether a strategy can be successfully carved out to make this work.
I don't know. It's a very difficult, very complicated situation. In the end, how do you get the Pashtun population to be willing to put their lives on the line to support the government? And, of course, one answer is to make the government better, more effective. But it's not clear that even if you do that, at this stage, it's going to work because the population in large parts of the country has already lost confidence in the government. And, of course, these elections, and regardless of how they turn out, but the fact that there was so much fraud, the fact that they've been so debated, it clearly is going to make it more difficult for the for any government, but particularly a Karzai government, to establish its credibility.
Here's President Obama just a few days after the Afghan election. He was talking here on August 21st.
I want to say a few words about this week's election in Afghanistan. This was an important step forward in the Afghan people's efforts to take control of their future, even as violent extremists are trying to stand in their way. This election was run by the Afghan people. In fact, it was the first democratic election run by Afghans in over three decades.
President Obama on August 21st. That doesn't sound so great now, Mr. Ambassador. These weeks later, when you're saying that there was massive fraud, did the White House miss something at the beginning, or just not want to see what was going on?
I would not have made that statement on the 21st of August. But in fairness to President Obama, what people were very much focused on the 20th of August and the 21st of August was that the Afghan people had turned out to vote. In parts of the country, they had done so at considerable personal risk. The Taliban had made a major effort to disrupt the elections. The elections were nonetheless held. The effort to disrupt the elections, however, severely depressed the turnout in the Pashtun areas. in many of the key provinces, it was well below 10%. But he was focusing on the fact that the belief at some level that the insurgency hadn't worked. And, of course, at that time, the results were not known, although there was growing evidence of fraud even at that time.
Of course, we know what we know now, and now is when they have to make a very big decision. Let's get a call from Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air with Peter Galbraith.
Hello. I don't see any big difference between this election, as I heard it covered. I wasn't there. And the first time he was elected, there was, like, disappearing indelible ink. There was identity papers for sale, wholesale, on the black market on the street. In my opinion, at that time, Karzai was our guy, and now he's not.
What's your experience in Mark in Afghanistan, Mark? Were you there?
No, never. I just what I hear on the news, and I heard the coverage of the first election, and it sounds pretty much like this, with the notable exception of our reaction to it.
Let us pick it up, Ambassador Galbraith.
There were the kinds of problems that Mark is describing in the 2004 election and in this election, but I would describe that as retail fraud. That is to say, people voting twice, they remove the supposedly indelible ink, they buy additional registration cards. In a close election, that kind of fraud can make a difference. But even if you try to vote all day, you have to go from one polling center to another. There are just so many ballots that you could cast, maybe 20, 30. It's that kind of fraud, again, is not going to change the result unless it's a close election. But what we had in this election was wholesale fraud. That is to say, in at least 1,000 polling centers, the polling centers never opened, and yet votes were manufactured in those polling centers, or perhaps not even manufactured, merely reported. And in that circumstance, it's possible that one-third of the votes that President Karzai was reported to have received were fraudulent. Incidentally, there was also fraud in the tally of Dr. Abdullah and Ramzan Bashardos, the third candidate, and maybe in some of the others, but not on the scale that there was for President Karzai.
You wrote in the letter that's now public that Karzai would have, but not for fraud, been forced into a runoff against the second-place finisher, Abdullah. Is it too late? Is there still a way that this might be brought back on the straight and narrow, Peter Galbraith?
Indeed, it might. There is an Election Complaints Commission that is doing an audit of the suspect ballot boxes. It doesn't have time to do an audit of all the ballot boxes and still have a runoff election this year. So they're doing an audit of a random sample, some 300 of the 3,000 suspect polling stations. But if that audit finds that all those 300 are fraudulent, they'll exclude the larger group, the 3,000, and I would think that likely would lead to a runoff. Now, the problem with a runoff is that the same problems that took place in the August election likely will recur in the October election unless there are changes. What are the changes that are required? First, one needs to close down the ghost polling stations, remove them from the book so you can't report returns from polling centers that never opened.
They're ghost in the sense that they literally never opened?
Yeah, they never opened.
But yet they had results reported.
They had results reported. They were said to be located in areas that the Afghan government didn't control, either the Taliban controlled or they were very insecure. So because of that, candidate agents couldn't go to observe the voting. Observers couldn't go to observe. It was quite easy to manufacture votes in those circumstances. This is why I raised that issue in July, why it was so central. So that's one of the things critic, you need to do.
Your critics in the UN said, how could the UN have the presumption to insist that these be closed down just because it was difficult? How do you not have polling stations where there are Afghans in an Afghan election?
But it was clear in July that those polling stations were never going to exist. These were in areas that, and I met with the Afghan defense minister, the interior minister, the head of the Independent Election Commission, Nobody, none of them had ever been to that location, and not just them personally, but none of their personnel had been to their location because it was inaccessible. So there was no discussion here that this was not about disenfranchising voters. Those voters who for whom that location might have been the closest polling center were already disenfranchised because that polling center was never going to open.
Let's get a call from Kenny in Nashville, Tennessee. Kenny, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I realize at the outset this may sound naive, but I'm really serious about this. I recently saw a documentary about Freedom Summer in Mississippi back in 1964,
okay.
because Mississippians who were black were so utterly disenfranchised that it's almost as if they were in a third world country.
And people came down to help them get to the polls and get the vote. Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole idea was, as Bob Moses put it in the documentary, that the problem is that laws didn't actually cover black Mississippians. But if a lot of students came down from the north, from the northeast, that they would get attention, their families would be invested. And again, to get to the point here, I guess my suggestion or my question to mm-hmm. Ambassador Galbraith is this. I saw recently something celebrating the Peace Corps and was actually surprised to discover that we have fewer than 8,000 volunteers spread among nearly 80 countries worldwide. So my suggestion is this. As a person-to-person effort, what would be the possibilities for getting Americans to go to Afghanistan without guns? I understand that it's a very dangerous place, but I was so impressed that kind of reaching out. My question is, could something like that work? It wouldn't even have to be run through the Peace Corps. It could also incorporate private philanthropic efforts, but I'm talking about not just a few hundred. And I know that international and American relief efforts are staffed by very serious, very caring people. But
Kenny, let us go to it. I think we've got it. A Freedom Summer for Afghanistan, hundreds, thousands of Americans, I don't know, walking arm in arm with Afghans to the polls. Would they be mowed down, Ambassador Galbraith, or is that – what do you say to Kenny?
First, I mean, Kenny has a very nice thought there. And there are hundreds I think actually thousands of American civilians in Afghanistan. They're part of our of the U.S. Embassy, taking personal risk to help the Afghan people. They are working in government ministries. They're beginning to work on the local level with local governments. They are in the NGO community and the charity community, so they're there. But a large number of Americans coming over who don't speak the language, don't know about Afghanistan, are not likely to have much to offer in the situation. And if they went to the parts of the country that are the most difficult, where the insurgency is, it isn't that they'd be mowed down. It's that they likely would be kidnapped. The abduction is the number one threat to foreigners, and then they become a huge issue. The lives of troops are put at risk as people try to find out where they are, to try to rescue them. So while I applaud the sentiment that lies behind Kenny's suggestion, it's, I think, not very practical in the context of Afghanistan 2009.
Peter Galbraith, let us pull the curtain back here a little bit on the region and on your thoughts. Your family's been involved in this region for a long time. Your father, famous economist John Kenneth Galbraith, ambassador to India in the 1960s. When you look at what's going on, we have a question here online asking for your views on India's role, Pakistan's role in Afghanistan, the whole region. Do you see a way that this can move forward positively, and are we lined up with pushing for that way now? Are you optimistic about something coming out of this, or you know, there's some pretty apocalyptic scenarios out there these days?
There are apocalyptic scenarios, but there's also a basis for hope. Why is Afghanistan so important? Well, one reason is that it's integrally linked to Pakistan. It's the same Pashtun community that's in Afghanistan that is in the northwest frontier and tribal areas of Pakistan. It is Al-Qaeda has moved from Afghanistan to Pakistan, and Pakistan is a country six times the size of Afghanistan. It has a powerful military, which also has great influence in the country. It has, of course, nuclear weapons. And so one reason we have to be concerned about Afghanistan is, in fact, the stability of Pakistan. And there has been some positive developments. A year ago, the dictatorship of Pervez Musharraf was overthrown. There's now a civilian president, Asif Zardari, and a civilian government. Coming after so many years of dictatorship, it had a shaky start, but it now seems to be moving to be in greater control than previous civilian governments. Again, it really doesn't control the military or the intelligence services, but seems to be working with them. It has patched things up with the civilian opposition, and importantly, it's had a success in dealing with the Taliban insurgency in Swat. At one point, the Taliban were within 60 miles of the capital, Islamabad. They have been pushed back. So that's a bright spot, and I have to give great credit here to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who saw the situation deteriorating in February and March, moved quickly to intervene, established good relations with both Zardari and the leader of the opposition, Nawaz Sharif, got them to patch up their quarrel, has played a big role in getting humanitarian assistance up to Swat. Mm. So there have been some successes. Pakistan remains a volatile place, but perhaps a little less dangerous than it was 6 months ago.
Next door to Afghanistan. You're an old friend of Richard Holbrooke. What are you or would you be advising him on more troops, more U.S. troops for Afghanistan? Yay or nay, Peter Galbraith?
No, at this time. I think it doesn't make sense to send in the troops, which would be part of a counterinsurgency mission aimed at helping to build local governance, protect the population in circumstances where you don't have a credible partner.
And what about Iran? You were very involved there, particularly with the Kurds in Kurdistan, but with Iraq, I should say, but with the whole picture, there's movement now already to take troops out of Iraq, move troops to Afghanistan. Is Iraq ready for troops to leave? Is it settled and now the U.S. can turn and focus entirely on Afghanistan or something else?
Well, there is an agreement that goes back to the Bush administration for the U.S. troops to withdraw. They've already withdrawn from the main cities. Parts of Iraq are increasingly stable. Iraq does have a constitution that involves a power sharing among the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shiites. There'll be elections in January. That may change the political composition structure of the country. May lead to a result that'll make it easier for these groups to work out their differences. But it is a very different situation. At least among the Kurds and the Sunnis, you have the political power rests with the with elected parties that actually exercise authority in the area, and that's not the case in Afghanistan. The government really doesn't exercise authority in much of the Pashtun area.
Do you think there's a risk of Iraq losing its progress if U.S. troops are pulled out to go into Afghanistan?
No, I haven't followed the situation in Iraq as closely as I used to. I've been focused on mm-hmm. Afghanistan, but my basic instinct is to say no. I think that there's been a lot of progress in Iraq, and I'm not sure how much the U.S. troops are contributing at this point to the stability of the country anyhow.
And we've just got half a minute here, but I wonder about your views on the United Nations now. Recalled by the Secretary General, that's not fun. Are you still ready and willing to work with the U.N.? Do you think the U.N. has a net positive role in Afghanistan?
Well, first, I'm a great admirer of the United Nations. When I worked for the Senate, I was responsible for the budget and always tried to get it fully funded. I worked with the U.N. in the Balkans, for the U.N. in East Timor. it is the tooth of what is done in the world. These are the people at the front line having the interaction. The UN mission in Afghanistan is extremely important. I'm just disappointed that that at least in Afghanistan it was an institution where private dissent could become a firing offense. It's not that I mind being fired personally, but I think the principle is a terrible one. It wouldn't work in the U.S.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.